Okay. You may proceed. I'll let you know as you get count close.
Yeah, if I could have a warning at possibly the 3-minute time zone, I would appreciate that.
Will do.
So what I was saying, Your Honor, is that I believe there's only a few key matters that I want to touch on that are dispositive in this case. And of course, I'd be happy to respond to any questions that the panel may have. So on July 23rd, 2018, both of my clients were faced with a dangerous confrontation with Mr. Warden. And they were faced with making a split-second decision that deadly force was necessary in light of Mr. Warden's conduct.
Maybe you can help me. Maybe you can help me on this. Just, I think I've gone over the facts a million times, and I know that, you know, the analysis is ultimately going to come down to what a reasonable officer have thought at the time when the shots were fired. But how do I factor in that Mr. Warden, but that seems weird because we always have cases with the warden on habeas cases, so it seems, but Mr. Warden, obviously there had been this kind of crime spree, as it were, I mean, one way to characterize it, but then in the final moments, the officers had been told twice that he had a gun, but he really didn't have a gun, all right? And I think we have to give Mr. Warden all the inferences of what his movement was. Mr. Warden, the officers have one way that they say that Mr. Warden behaved, but the Mr. Warden says he kind of did a push-up, and the officers also think that Mr. Warden has been shot because they were told one of the officers had, well, there had been shots fired. So they believe Mr. Warden had been shot. They've been told twice that he has a gun, and he's down on the ground, and we have to give him the inference that he did like a push-up. So, but now we know that he didn't have a gun. So how does all of that factor together? How do we analyze those last times in terms of a reasonable officer? Because it turns out, obviously, some of the information that the officers had was not correct. And Mr. Warden wasn't armed. He was shot 16 or 17 times. And how do we see that to get to your position? How do we factor in all those things?
Sure. Thank you for the question, Your Honor. I think we factor in all of those conditions based upon what we knew up to that point and where the information came from that Officer Weaver and Officer Cowan both believed that Mr. Warden was armed. That information came from their own senior officer who was right there with Mr. Warden. They first heard it over the radio, and then they heard it again on scene that Mr. Warden is armed with a weapon. So they have information from their fellow officer that Mr. Warden is armed. I think that is crucial to this analysis. And then moving to where,
but there's
Mr. Warden,
a disputed fact about how they say Mr. Warden's body was and how Mr. Warden says his body was. So the officers are not entitled at this stage to have their side of the story about how the body was, right? We have to go with Mr. Warden's side. Or is that just a disputed fact that throws this all into that it has to go to trial?
I don't think that's a disputed fact that necessarily requires a trial, because we can rely upon what Mr. Warden actually said as to what took place. And important here is from the perspective of the officers, they're on scene with somebody who they believe is armed with a weapon, okay? And this gentleman, Mr. Warden, is now on the ground. They're not firing their handguns at somebody who is simply laying there on the ground motionless. The only reason Officer Cowan and Officer Warden, they decided to fire their weapons is because those outstretched hands, where Mr. Warden was told to keep his hands outstretched, kind of like a cross position, he took those hands and he brought those into the midline of his chest. And as he described it, it was his intention to do a push-up maneuver because he was concerned that the officers that he knew had weapons drawn, that he knew believed he had a gun, he was concerned they didn't know he didn't have a gun. I get that. I get what he's saying. But from the officer's perspective, they think he has a gun, and he makes that movement with outstretched hands to a way that he can easily grab a weapon that might be concealed under his body.
So how do you distinguish, like, the case of Cruz v. the city of Anaheim in analyzing those facts?
Sure. So on Cruz, the important distinction that required a jury trial is that it involved the decedent. It was brought by the estate. There was no testimony by the decedent himself because obviously he had passed away. In this situation, we have Mr. Warden's own sworn deposition testimony that he made that fateful reach, that he brought his outstretched hands from that safe position where he was not being fired upon towards the midline of his body that caused the officers to fear for their safety and the safety of the other people in the residential area. But I think we can also go a step beyond that, Your Honor. Is not only did Mr. Warden testify to that under sworn deposition testimony, but he also agreed to stipulated facts in his conviction for violating Penal Code Section 69. Penal Code Section 69, part and parcel, requires that there are threats or violence or resistance by force of violence by the perpetrator. In this case, Mr. Warden agreed on the record in the criminal court that the basis for his criminal conviction is contained within the summary as prepared by Detective Soxoto. Within that summary, it states that he was uncooperative with Corporal Williams. He began motioning with his hands as if preparing to draw a weapon from his waistband. In that summary, he stipulates that Corporal Williams gave him multiple commands to show his hands, but he continued to make those movements in the area of his waistband, causing Corporal Williams to fire that shot.
Doesn't Mr. Warden argue that other objective facts contradict the officer's belief that he actually had a gun in his waistband?
The only fact that he testifies to is that when he brought his arms in, he made that fateful movement and pushes himself up on the ground and turns towards the officer is to tell them that he didn't have a weapon. That is the disputed fact of what he is saying. He doesn't have a weapon, whereas the Corporal Williams is saying he did have a weapon.
What is your may I ask the question, what is your best case that supports your position here? Is Cruz the best case, or is there some other case?
I think Cruz and George and Centeno are the three cases that are right on point. They all hold the proposition that it's unquestionably justified to use deadly force on a suspect that you believe is armed and dangerous if they make that fateful movement, if they make that furtive movement. And that's exactly what Mr. Warden did when he brought his outstretched hands toward the midline of his body. Now, the officers can't speculate as to what he is going to do. All they can actually see is that he brought his hands from that safe position directly to areas where it would be known for an individual to conceal a handgun or a weapon. But I wanted to keep going on the stipulated facts, because the stipulated facts in the criminal proceeding don't just relate to Corporal Williams. They didn't stop after Corporal Williams fired that shot and Mr. Warden dropped to the ground. Importantly, within those stipulated facts, Mr. Warden agrees and that he continued to be uncooperative with all three officers. And he continued to reach for his waistband when all three officers were there. And at that point is when he was shot by Officers Cowan and Weaver. He stipulates in that criminal conviction that he was simulating that he had a gun, or that he had a weapon, I apologize. It's those stipulations that he stuck with in the criminal proceeding, because that would turn his criminal conviction upside down. It would be absolutely meaningless. And that's what the Heck Doctrine is all about. That's what judicial estoppel is all about. And this is why qualified immunity applies to Officers Cowan and Weaver, because Mr. Warden simply cannot establish as a matter of law that he wasn't a threat. He already stipulated to that fact.
Well, okay, he can't. If this case isn't heck barred as to the two officers that you, it was found to be heck barred as to the officer on the that prior confronted him, correct? It's not, you're not arguing it's heck barred as to these two officers, are you?
I am, and frankly, I should have articulated that better in the district court, but made that argument within our points and authorities because as to apply qualified immunity to officers Weaver and Cowan, you can use the heck doctrine principles to establish that he cannot go back on what he stipulated to in the criminal court. He shouldn't be allowed to do that. He's making two different factual scenarios. And if he were allowed to do that, like I said, it turns his criminal conviction of violating Penal Code 69 up on its head as if it's meaningless. And that's the hallmark of the Heck Doctrine. And that's exactly why qualified immunity applies in this scenario. He cannot establish as a matter of law that he was not a threat.
I'm not sure I've seen a case, and maybe you can help me on it, that where there's an intersection between Heck and the qualified immunity analysis. I take your point that you're saying that these are, you can't have two versions of the facts, but do you have a case?
I frankly don't, Your Honor. And that's why I believe this is a little bit unique, is that we can clearly apply Heck to Officer Williams, but it is a bit fuzzy as to whether that actual doctrine applies to officers Weaver and Officer Cowan. But those principles do apply. There is no reason not to apply it because the consequences are the same. If we don't apply those principles, then we come with two juxtaposed situations where in one court, Mr. Warden is able to stipulate that he was a threat, and in another court, he's able to change his mind in his civil case and say he wasn't. That turns his entire criminal conviction of Penal Code 69 up on its head.
I think Judge Seiler had a question.
I was just going to ask, he stipulated that he had a gun. Is that what you're saying?
No, he stipulated that he was simulating that he had a weapon, and he stipulated that he continued to reach for his waistband despite the fact that the officers repeatedly told him not to move and to keep his hands out.
So you're down to about 3 minutes. Do you want to reserve?
I will. Thank you, Your Honors.
Very good. How is our clock situation? Got it? They're still working on it? Okay. Second, let me reset here. All right, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors. If it pleases the court, Brian McComas on behalf of Masa Warden via the pro bono panel appointment. I appreciate everyone's patience today with the technical difficulties. Errors happen, and thankfully, unlike on July 23rd, 2018, no one will die from an error in the courtroom today. But on July 23rd, 2018, those errors threatened my client's life with a barrage of bullets. I'm going to start with the discussion of Heck here because it does not apply to officers Cohen and Weaver. Those charges were dismissed. That's simple.
Well, so let's, I think we can jump in because I think we all are pretty factually aware, but people may see them differently. And thank you for your pro bono work. We appreciate both of you being here, but we appreciate that. Do you concede, though, I'm not really necessarily buying that this is heck barred. I'm not buying that. But I do think that there's some water in the argument that you can't say one thing and then later say something completely different and get full credit on that. But do you concede that officers Cohen and Weaver could reasonably rely on Corporal Williams' statements that Mr. Warden had a gun in his waistband? And if so, why not? Because it seems like the case law is, the officers were told twice by another officer that that he did have a gun. And I am additionally troubled by the fact that he says that your client says in another court proceeding that he was acting like he had a gun. So it seems that the case law would indicate that the two officers that shot your client are entitled to rely on that they were told twice that he had a gun.
Yes, Your Honor. I'm going to start with the claim that my client says things differently in different courts. First of all, he is not a lawyer. His arraignment is where he was pled at. I've never seen that before. He's wheeled in from a hospital on pleas. He doesn't know exactly what's going on. And if you talk to a good lawyer, he'd explain to you.
Well, a good lawyer can tell you don't say certain things, but all of us know the difference between the truth and a lie. That's not, you know, the fact that someone gets tricked because they don't have a good lawyer, I don't think that means you can back away from something you said.
What I'm getting at, Your Honor, is that his lawyer should have explained to him what the elements of Penal Code 69 are. Those are divisible. I refer the court to Manual G, 16 Cal 4th, 805, and People versus Atkins. These are state cases. But you can violate Penal Code Section 69 with a threat unaccompanied by any physical force. And so you can also violate Penal Code 69 by trying to deter an officer from future lawful conduct. And what I would have explained to my client is that when you are pleading to this Penal Code Section 69, that is limited to Mr. Williams. Yes, there's a stipulated facts underneath that, but they didn't stipulate specifically to he had a gun, which he didn't, or he was simulating that he had a gun. And my client denies he did that when he has a chance to testify.
Well, what's in the record? What's in the record?
The record of the plea or the record of the syllabus?
Well, the record of what the stipulated facts are. What's in the record?
Just simply the police report. We stipulate to the police report. And a better attorney would have carved out a better stipulation there, recognizing that Cohen and Weaver are not part of the admission to the Penal Code Section 69. I'm going to move on to the claim of affirmative movement. That is exactly the type of disputed factual issue that we need a jury to decide. And furtive comes from furtum.
Well, but how does it? But the jury is going to be instructed. My understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, because a lot of these don't ever go to trial. But my understanding is the jury is going to have to be instructed as to what would a reasonable officer have thought. Not whether it was a furtive move. What would a reasonable? They'll hear everything that happened that day, starting with that your client, you know, punched a guy in the face, went swimming in his clothes a couple of times, had the interchange of the evading arrest. They're going to hear all of that, and then the jury will be instructed. What would a reasonable officer think? Not what you would think, right? It's not a reasonable person. It's a reasonable officer, right?
Yes. And there's factors for the jury to consider. Need and amount of force. How many gunshots are necessary at this moment after we already believe he's shot? I want to touch on something Your Honor mentioned. Should we reasonably rely on Officer Williams? No, we should not here. There is radio calls all day for two different offenses. Not one single person reports seeing a firearm. They do report he's swimming in the Sacramento River. I don't know how a firearm works after that. There's also evidence in the record that he discards everything in his hands as he's walking up Mary Street from Jenny Creek. And so if this officer sees he's got nothing in his hands, I think that we don't have to rely on any reports as objective, particularly if you look at Corporal Williams' declaration. He says, I thought I shot him. He says that moment was over. It wasn't emergency at that moment. It's not till the two officers come up and Mr. Warden is on the ground. Now, this is important. He says he's on his stomach.
Well, is it okay? But I agree. It's in evidence. There was a shot fired and the officers believe that your client has been shot. So I think that that's not a disputed fact here. It turns out your client wasn't shot, so that was another thing that was wrong. It turns out he wasn't armed, and it turns out he wasn't shot. But the officers believed he had been shot. Does that end the inquiry? Can a person that's been shot not fire a gun anymore?
No, that doesn't end the inquiry. I'd encourage the court to look at Zion and Snap. It's the other case, Jones, by Judge Kaczynski, which he encourages. And we would tell the jury that officers are supposed to reevaluate the situation as circumstances change.
Okay, on Zion, you're mentioning that on the second prong of the qualified immunity, your brief focuses on Zion. But the facts there seem to be pretty distinguishable because the suspect was disarmed and incapacitated at the time of the second round of shots in Zion. That's not So I don't know if that's a good case for what you're talking about.
Well, I can appreciate that the facts are different. They go on to stomp on Zion's head unnecessarily. I look at AKH. I look at the other cases we cited, Torres, even AD, which involves an intentional shooting, a finding by the jury. Well, my client alleged that in the complaint. It was screened out, but we could see that again at trial. I just think, Your Honor, you have to look at this one critical disputed fact, and you touched on it earlier, is that Mr. Warden testified he was laying on his stomach and arms out to a push-up. That's far different than reaching for waistband again, but more importantly, there's corroborating evidence. My client was shot in his buttocks. His tib fib was shattered. The shots are coming from the back, and that is a disputed factual issue that a jury from the Eastern District needs to decide. And I want to hit this, it's really important to me, because a quote, furtive movement is the exact thing that ended stop and frisk in New York City.
Do you think that the Cruz case is the best case involved here, or there's a better case for your position?
I'm sorry for interrupting, Your Honor. I think the Cruz case and the Foster case are the best for my position because they prove there's no jurisdiction here in light of the factual disputes we've identified. I have to hit this, though. The furtive claim is exactly the type of subjective testimony from an officer that needs to be evaluated by a jury from the Eastern District. And that jury needs to be as diverse as the Eastern District so that we have African-American people who understand when it's claimed that you're acting like a thief. That's what furtive means. You're acting sly. These are not things that the African-American community takes lightly. These are the reasons why stop and frisk stopped in New York. And a jury would
it's
get to
But it's pretty that, yeah, that those things you can mention, but your client punched someone in the face, was running around acting crazy. There was indications he was on drugs. He evaded the police officer, and he went into an occupied dwelling. He stole some, you know, someone was there. You know, going into an occupied dwelling, even though people like to minimize that, but when you go into someone's house, bad things happen. People don't think you're there to say hello and to chat about how the weather is. So, you know, he had been on a pretty violent crime spree, and the officers are entitled to have that in their minds too, aren't they?
Yes, Your Honor, and you know, they shot Garner going over a fence because he committed a burglary at night. My client didn't do a home invasion with a gun. My client wasn't even seen in the house with another person, I don't believe. And I agree, the officers are tracking him on the old rail trail and the Sacramento River Trail, and they find him in Mary Creek, and they do believe they have probable cause at that point to make an arrest. The question, though, is the reasonableness of the amount of force used. And I'd like Your Honors to consider, is it reasonable as shot two? Is it reasonable as shot four? I mean, what number does it become unreasonable to continue to pump a man full of bullets?
You think the quantity of the fires, shots fired from the pistol, is a big factor here? In other words, if the officer just shot him one time, that would be different than what they did?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And think of it like this. They're claiming lethal force. One shot would have done it. When they missed and continue firing, and my client's screaming, "Jesus, save me," and it's clear he's not able to fire a weapon because he is under so many bullets, and these are shattering on the ground, putting shrapnel all over him, and he is telling them, "I don't have a firearm." At the minimum, I'd expect an objective officer to consider that fact, especially when it proves true.
Can you tell me about, I noticed in the record before he had counsel and he filed this, he never filed a list of undisputed facts, and the judge basically did it for him. I think the other side asked to have it. I mean, generally, if you don't do things, that's the end of it. It looks like he had a little help here.
I wish he had had the help from an attorney. Your Honor, I'd like you to look at EOR 47. That is a note from my client. And there's several of these notes that due to the COVID-19, there's no way here in prison to give a copy of the motion to defendants because I have no access to the law library. I mean, he filed these over and over again because he doesn't have an ability to do anything on himself. And if you really expect my uneducated client who is going, he files this from a healthcare prison to understand he needs to file disputed factual issues without an attorney. Well, that's why we have standards that recognize leniency for pro bono or pro per plaintiffs. I really think that we should look at these because I heard that my client made a fateful reach that justified the shots. No, he tucked. He tucked his arms here and he had already fallen. And I hope that an objective officer could see that when he fell, there was no gun that fell up below him. There was no effort to pull a gun out of his chest. And they're confusing two incidents. The first incident with Mr.
Would
Williams.
Would your argument be different? Okay, let's say if the officers had, would, in your view, if the officers had fired one shot, would you still say that was too much?
Maybe that would be objective. They each took a shot. Maybe they could have tried.
Well, no, but what's been your argument in this case? You're arguing they can't take any shots, right? But then if, or are you arguing they took too many? What are you arguing?
I'm arguing I need a chance at trial to prove which shot exactly started the unreasonable.
Well, okay, but if we apply the law, the information that the officers had, are you saying they could have each taken one shot based on what they knew at that time? Based on the movement that your client made? They could have taken one, or are you saying they just couldn't take the number, or are you saying they couldn't take any, or what is your argument?
Well, I'm not going to argue against Penal Code 69 with Williams at this point, so I'll let that be clear. But as to the other two officers, yes, Your Honor, I believe that de-escalation, clearly this is a mentally ill person who they knew or thought was on drugs, and to resort to the most lethal form 17 times over is unreasonable when you have pepper spray, canines, pain compliance techniques, all types of lesser
remedies. Was there a dog out there?
I'm not sure, but I'm just naming some remedies right now, or lesser options. These are all things that I need a chance to depose these officers about. And I have one critical fact also for you, is that it does not appear that we have a declaration from Officer Cohen. So I don't even know if the officers dispute each other. What I'd like is a chance to depose these officers. What I think is right is we need a trial for a genuine dispute of facts. And I don't think there's jurisdiction here because of the number of disputed factual issues. So I'm going to ask that the court remand this with instructions to grant my motion to decertify this appeal, to find that there's no jurisdiction, to deny qualified immunity, and to deny this hybrid Heck claim that lacks support in the case law. And I'll rest unless the court has more questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
And I think our timer is now working, so we'll put 3 minutes on for rebuttal.
Counsel, very good, Nick. Can you respond to the, I want to focus on that. Can you respond to the number of shots? I'm trying to get my arms around the argument here that in my mind, it basically distills, the way I'm analyzing it is what did the officers know at the time that Mr. Cowan did the push-up? But what about the number of shots? I'm hearing that more articulated. What would you say about that?
Sure. I think it's second guessing in hindsight the officer's perspective and trying to use that 2020 hindsight and implant our own views into what the officers on the scene in an intense situation had. And as I understand the case law, Your Honor, you're not limited to one shot, reassess, reshoot one more time, reassess. You're entitled to be able to shoot until the threat is extinguished. And that's exactly the case law at the time that this took place.
So does the record show what kind of weapons they had? I mean, did they basically unload their magazines or what? Is there anything in the record that I can look at on that?
Sure. And each officer, Officer Cowan, Officer Weaver, submitted declarations in the summary judgment motion. They're out next to, close to Mr. Warden. They each have their handguns drawn at that point, knowing that force had been used previously. There was no dog. They would have to have holstered their handguns to even find pepper spray if they had it. There's nothing in the records to indicate that they had those less lethal options available to them. They already tried the verbal commands, and they tried repeatedly and clearly with those verbal commands, but Mr. Warden just simply ignored them. And what's scary about the arguments that I have heard this morning, that you can't rely on what a fellow officer has told you, that scares me, because that puts the officers, that puts the public all in a game of Russian roulette with a known suspect that has violent tendencies and who those officers firmly believe is armed with a weapon. The law doesn't require the officers or the public to be sitting ducks to somebody who is that dangerous.
Right, but
there is no law on point that says that. I think, to
Judge Callahan's point, he was shot by his own testimony 16 or 17 times. That's, I think, disputed perhaps, but if that's so, then even if we get beyond the first round of shots, that's a lot of shots being fired for somebody who's made a movement like this. I mean, it seems to me the question is, did the movement, was it furtive? Would a reasonable officer have responded to it as a threatening move or not? And the district court seemed to think that was a genuine issue of material fact about that. And the second one was the use of that many rounds. I mean, those seem to be the disputed facts at issue. Even crediting that they thought he had a weapon.
Sure, and I could go back and look at, it was Zion, where the court considered two different rounds of shooting. In that first round, that officer unloaded 9 rounds into that gentleman.
Yeah, well, 9 rounds. But there are other cases like Tan Lam, where there was an initial shooting, and it was the second shot that was the issue. So I guess the... your position is, once there's a, if you can justify a furtive movement, you can fire as many rounds as are necessary.
My position is that they are able to file as many rounds as necessary to have the threat ceased. And there is no evidence to show that the threat stopped immediately after the first, second, or third round.
Very good. Your time has expired unless there are further questions. Thank you both for your arguments this morning. And it's an interesting case, and we will deliberate on it. Thanks again, and sorry for the technical difficulties.
Thank you.
No problem. Thank you for your time, Reverend.